Simply place the Berkey Solar Charger in the sun, plug in your application, and you have power. Disconnect your application, and the system automatically begins charging its own rechargeable batteries. Get the incredible Berkey Solar.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views. And for the next year, time, they're going to be the views of Russ Baker, who's written a fascinating story called Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, The Powerful Forces That Put It in the White House, and What Their Influence Means for America. Russ, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, it's a fascinating book, and I just feel a friendly heart here. I feel somebody who's looking at the world very much as we are. And so I'm just going to go down with some of the questions, because it seems to be your contention that there is an elite force, an elite group that rules America, and they put the Bushes in the White House. Would that be a fair assumption?
I think that is generally correct. And, in fact, I think they put a lot of presidents, or at least influenced a lot of presidents, on their way in and sometimes on their way out prematurely.
All right, fine. Well, you mentioned a couple of things here. First, about Sidney. George Herbert Walker Bush's association with the Central Intelligence Agency. Most people were not aware of the fact that he was affiliated with the CIA long before he was appointed as the director of the CIA back in, what was it, 1975, 1976. What's the story there? Why is there a great deal of evidence that he was a CIA asset in one way or another for many years before he was ever appointed to be the director of the Central Intelligence Agency?
Sure. If I could just back up, if you don't mind, for a second, just to give your listeners a little bit of context. The book we're talking about, Family of Secrets, was not intended to go into the subject that you and I are about to discuss, adult life. And this goes back at least 23 years prior to when he was the CIA director.
And, of course, that seems to be covered up. In fact, every time the people who try to look into that, they sort of get into a blank wall of the CIA and say, well, we will neither agree or comment or deny what was the term that they used. In other words, the term they always use, we will neither confirm nor deny. So, obviously, all they had to do is say, well, he was never part of our organization, but they didn't say that. They just won't confirm or deny.
And that's right. And so what I do with Family of Secrets, the leader now simply behind the scenes, Vladimir Putin, who was a lifelong intelligence officer, and there was a lot of criticism of that, of bringing those sorts of anti-democratic methods into the leadership of a powerful country. And so, of course, that would have been the same dialogue in this country had anybody known about this. But we go back.
Anything to do with Barbara Bush, just lots of little coincidences. But certainly there's a lot of documentation, not simply speculation. But these were actually declassified government documents that you had showing George Bush's relationship with the Central Intelligence Agency. One of the things, however, that you bring out is the fact that that the CIA seems to have a very close relationship with the executive branch of government. Would that be a fair appraisal?
Well, I think one of the concerns that emerged from my reporting of Family of Secrets is the whole question of the proper role of a secretive, very powerful agency in a democracy. And, most people don't realize this, but the CIA, we did not have a peacetime intelligence agency prior to World War II. The CIA was launched right after World War II. Incidentally, by the key architect of it was a man who was actually a business partner of Prescott Bush, the grandfather of the recent President Bush. And their circle was very, very influential in creating the so-called national security state. Harry Truman, after reluctantly approving it later on, said he came to regret it, that he thought this was a bad idea and that this was perhaps a dangerous precedent. Now, the reason, Dr. Stan, that I'm so interested in all this and that it's relevant to today is that we have very, very little understanding of how our country actually works. And I would go so far as to say that that's the case under all presidents. And what I do in Family of Secrets is I show that whether it was George W. Bush, we find out that so many of the things we were told about him were not true. The same thing about his father, but also about all of these presidents, how they were elected, who they were, what they were doing, how they were removed from office, whether it was John F. Kennedy violently or in the case of Richard Nixon peacefully. There turns out to be essentially a sort of secret history of this country, and the book has been very, very well received, including by some extremely influential people who, let's say, shall we say, commentators, who've remarked that they see this as a sort of a whole new history of the post-war era. And I have to say, it was a new history to me. This all came from just following a fact trail.
Well, I really want to congratulate you on the book. I think it's very well done, and we're going to carry the book. We think people should read Family of Secrets. And one of the things do you want to get into the background of the assassination, JFK assassination, or would you like to talk about?
Let's talk about that a little bit. The background there is, and I have to say that when I began doing a book, just trying to understand George W. Bush and why so much big money, so much huge military-industrial complex money, oil money, Wall Street money, why they bet so heavily on a guy who was clearly not qualified for the job, didn't have the temperament, the skills, the experience for the job. Why had they backed him up? And as I did that, I never imagined that I would be looking at things like Watergate and the Kennedy assassination. But what happened was, as I was trying to understand the sort of role of the Bush family with these very powerful elites, and looking at the father and his very rapid rise, despite a similar kind of a lack of apparent qualifications, the father had some very interesting things. First of all, he had said publicly that he could not remember where he was on November 22, 1963. Now, you know, I suspect you probably remember where you were.
I remember very clearly where I was. I was in surgery that morning. I remember coming out of surgery and, you know, thinking, you know, what is this going to mean for my country? But go right ahead.
Sure, and if there is a single listener out there listening to this program who was over the age of 5 years old at the time who cannot remember where they were, I'd love to hear from them. And they can go to our website, familyofsecrets.com, and there's a place where you can send emails. But honestly, nobody doesn't remember, and particularly a person such as Bush, who was 40 years old at the time and actually was a citizen of Texas. This is where Kennedy was at the time. And so I just thought, well, this is so strange. That's almost like a kind of deniability. Just doesn't even make any sense. And so I began to wonder, well, where was he? Well, he not only was in Texas, but he was actually running for political office on the Republican ticket at the time. He was running for U.S. Senate, and he was campaigning at that moment. And so I wondered, well, where exactly was he? And I discovered that, well, two things. I don't want to spoil the suspense, because one of the things I tried very hard to do with Family of Secrets was to, because there's so many names, so many facts, and so complicated, I worked very hard to make it read a little bit like a thriller. And so I don't want to give it all away. I don't want to give away that value. But I will say that, in fact, he was in Dallas. And he left Dallas, it appears, that morning, and he traveled to another place nearby. And it was from that other place he then calls the FBI, and he calls and he says, I'm a private citizen, and he gives his name, and he says, I'm calling here from Tyler, Texas, I may have some information on who shot the president. Well, of course, for a man who can't remember where he was that day, when you learn that he called to offer a tip, you say, well, there's something wrong with this. Certainly, and so there's much more to it. It turns out that the tip he offered was completely a red herring. It was completely misleading, and the man he reported was not a threat to the president. Moreover, he said he didn't know much about the man. He'd only heard some things, but in fact, he knew the man, and he knew he wasn't a threat. And in fact, Bush's own assistant was at the man's house about the time that they were reporting him, giving the man an alibi. And so this is a very complicated operation that was underway there. Another interesting document I feature in Family of Secrets is from the day after the assassination. It refers to a briefing given by the FBI to two intelligence operatives related to the assassination, and one of them mentioned in there is George Bush of the CIA, and it refers to his having some information or working with Cuban exiles and how they would react to the Kennedy assassination. Well, again, this is the same man who says he can't remember where he was, who insists he was a private citizen then, and who went on to head this powerful intelligence agency.
And yet this is an FBI document you quoted there. I think it goes, wasn't it Hoover is actually commenting that given the information to George W. Bush and somebody else, George Bush, they didn't say H.W. or W., they just said George Bush. And then, of course, there was a cover story. Well, there was another George Bush. That must have been the guy. It wasn't, of course, a George Herbert Walker Bush. It was just George William Bush. And of course, they tracked that down and of course, verified that was not the person the information went to.
Right. I mean, Dr. Stan, to give you a sense of how deep this all goes and how carefully planned very elaborate covert operations are. This other George Bush has said that he was hired, apparently solicited by the CIA and hired just shortly before the assassination to work in the agency. He had a very low-level position, and he says he never received any kind of FBI briefings and that he really was almost like a trainee. And then shortly after that period, they let him go, and he goes to another agency. So one has to ask, was he there for no other reason than to do exactly what they ended up using him for? And by the way, of course, as you point out, the CIA always says we neither confirm nor deny that somebody worked there. But when George H.W. Bush was about to be nominated for president in 1988, and some of this information came out, although nobody heard about it, it was hushed up, the CIA at first said they could neither confirm nor deny, and then they finally came out and they said, no, it's not him, it's another guy. Well, they would never do that. They would never say that it was another anybody, and so here they are saying that, and of course that was a cover story, and the other man wasn't the one at all, and so you begin with this stuff, and you look at layers and layers and layers, and you say, my gosh, what are we looking at here? I mean, I always assumed, never really paid much attention to the Kennedy assassination. It seemed to me just a morass, you know, something that was just sort of a bottomless pit. As a journalist, if I got into that, I'd never get out. And I guess I just, you know, I had heard, you know, people, the consensus was maybe Oswald did it, maybe he didn't do it, maybe others were involved. And I just didn't know. But once I started assembling all of this information, and by the way, there's a whole chapter in Family of Secrets on a fascinating Russian, a white Russian emigre with intelligence ties by the name of George de Morenschild, who was a friend of the was a longtime friend of George H.W. Bush, but also was, are you ready, the father figure, the kind of mentor to Lee Harvey Oswald in the year prior to the assassination. I mean, this is just astonishing.
Yes, I know. One of my friends actually spent a lot of time researching that. Of course, here's Morgan de Morenschild, is a friend of George Herbert Walker Bush. And so there are a lot of strange things. One of the things I thought it was so fascinating you brought out was that the government said, yes, it was another George William Bush, not George Herbert Walker Bush. It was George William Bush that got this directive from the CIA, from the Federal Bureau of Investigation, immediately after the Kennedy assassination. But they couldn't find him. They had no idea where he was. He disappeared, and somebody tracked him down. He was working for the government. But they couldn't find him.
They couldn't find him, they said. Well, you see, I mean, what's so interesting to me about all of this material, and happy to talk more about that, and of course we should talk about Watergate, which turns out to be equally fascinating, that the history and the way that we understand Watergate turns out to have been wrong as well. But what fascinates me about all of this is that we're talking about the United States, you know, in our name, these agencies have been involved in overthrowing democratically elected leaders all over the world. You know, we in Chile, whether you like them or not, Allende was democratically elected. The same thing with Arbenz in Guatemala. The same thing with Mossadegh in Iran. And all of these people were angering very powerful companies, whether it was Pepsi-Cola, sugar growers based on Wall Street, or it was the oil industry. There was always these powerful interests, and that's really where the book goes, the powerful interests that influence our president.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with Russ Baker. Well, Russ, go right ahead, because I guess certainly every time I think about the overthrow of Mossadegh and then the putting in the Shah and then overthrowing the Shah and putting in the mullahs, and now we're talking about the possibility of ending up and going to war with the mullahs over the fact that they're trying to develop a nuclear bomb. And you say, why didn't they leave Mossadegh in? Why didn't they leave the Shah in? Why are they always doing these things and interfering with other countries? Is that what this is all about? And after reading your book and, of course, our own studies, that's exactly what it's all about. So you pick up the story. What about Watergate? That was a fascinating part of the story.
Sure. I mean, now, again, I want to emphasize, as a more or less kind of a traditionally investigative journalist writing for, you know, serious major newspapers and magazines here and abroad, I'm not somebody who is attracted to sort of rash theories and so forth, and I'm very methodical. Here comes some more stuff about the elder Bush, George H.W. Bush. As I was looking at him, and I said, well, okay, so we know that he had a secret life. We know that he really covered up and lied about so much of that. We know that he was doing something with the agency at the time of the Kennedy assassination. Now you flash forward a little bit, and there's Richard Nixon and Poppy Bush, his nickname. Poppy Bush gets elected to the House of Representatives in 1966. And 2 years later, Nixon's nominated to be president of the United States, and a whole bunch of very powerful corporate executives, you've got the names of the companies there in my book, Family of Secrets, and they all start this lobbying campaign to Nixon that he's got to put young Poppy Bush, freshman congressman, on as vice president. And you think, well, holy cow, that's even more dramatic than Dan Quayle or, you know, any of these people who were so inexperienced. And so what was that about? Well, it turns out, Dr. Stan, that I did a bunch of research trying to figure out why Nixon even put Bush on the short list in 1968. Why in 1970 did he appoint him ambassador to the United Nations at a moment where there were all these sensitive negotiations going on, things with the opening of what was going to be the opening with China, of course the Vietnam War, and so many other things. Why put him, of everybody in the world, into a place where people like Eleanor Roosevelt and Adlai Stevenson and so forth are the kinds of names, or even a Gene Kirkpatrick, very experienced, that they would put him in, of all people? And in fact, he joked when he was named UN ambassador. He joked about the fact that, yes, he didn't know anything about it, but in 2 weeks he would. And so what was that all about? And what I discovered in researching this was that there was a secret relationship between Richard Nixon and the Bush family, and I can tell you, this has never been published anywhere. Not any of the hundreds of books about Nixon or the Bushes have ever come up with this. I discovered this in my research for Family of Secrets. I have one whole chapter about the background relationship between them. Essentially, Richard Nixon was plucked from obscurity in the 1940s to run for Congress from California, but not the typical story is that he was asked to run against this liberal Jerry Voorhees, who was described as too far to the left and sympathetic to labor unions and so on. Well, none of that was really correct. The truth was that Jerry Voorhees, about a decade after the Great Depression, he was very concerned about Wall Street excesses. And as a congressman, he was perhaps the leading voice on Capitol Hill saying, you know, we cannot afford another Great Depression. We don't know what these financial interests are doing, and we need some transparency for the investors, and so he constituted, Jerry Voorhees constituted a threat to the investment bankers.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, Russ Baker is our guest today. We're talking about his book, Family of Secrets, which I recommend to you, which we will be carrying. Anyway, he was talking about why was this George, this was Richard Nixon was going to run against Jerry Voorhees, or who was going to run against him?
Right. So what happened was Richard Nixon was plucked from obscurity to run against this congressman from California. And as I say, the reason that he was asked to run, it turns out, is not the reason that was presented, that Jerry Voorhees was just too liberal. I mean, there were lots of liberals in Congress, and why would people from all over the country have focused on this one man? And the reason was because Jerry Voorhees was the leading voice for keeping closer tabs on Wall Street, on the investment bankers and the brokers, and he was concerned about financial products and deception and so on with the investments and the savings of, you know, the American people. And of course, that story resonates very much today because we see the same thing. We see the same interests. And by the way, the Wall Street interest back in the 1940s that put Richard Nixon up included specifically Prescott Bush, the grandfather of George W. Bush, who at that time was a Wall Street investment banker and very, very involved in political activities, anti-FDR, anti-New Deal, activities on behalf of these wealthy interests. And so you see this continuity. And that's one of the themes of Family of Secrets, is the continuity that you see through three or even four generations of the Bush family serving these elite Wall Street interests. Now, what they do is they get Richard Nixon to run for Congress. He beats Voorhees, and then they immediately start promoting him to higher office. And so within just several years, he's a U.S. senator, and within just, again, just several years, he's put on the ticket with Dwight Eisenhower, who wasn't even a Republican. Dwight Eisenhower was being targeted by both parties, and he was really a figurehead. But this same group around Prescott Bush got Dwight Eisenhower to run for president. They convinced him to put Richard Nixon, who he didn't like, on the ticket. Richard Nixon became vice president, and he had oversight of covert operations. Prescott Bush gets elected to the U.S. Senate at the same time, and he becomes a key person. When there was no Senate Intelligence Committee, he was the de facto Senate Intelligence Committee, traveling, as I document in my book, Family of Secrets, to Hong Kong to check up on an operation where they try to assassinate the Chinese leader, Zhou Enlai, and this plot to poison his rice bowl failed. And there's Prescott Bush. They're demanding to know why this didn't work out. So you have a whole background with them basically running Richard Nixon, and they're essentially telling him what to do throughout his career. But 1968, he gets elected president, and suddenly, Dr. Stan, Richard Nixon decides, I'm the president now, and I've got a legacy to build. And he starts doing what he wants to do. And he starts with Kissinger having these secret negotiations with America's enemies. He's trying to create peace. He is trying to end the Vietnam War. He's trying to end the Cold War. And basically what happens is the people who backed him, when they decide that he turned against them and they turn against him. And in Family of Secrets, I have three chapters with all new information about Watergate. And that story, guess who shows up again? George H.W. Bush in Watergate, bringing Richard Nixon down.
And of course, Richard, if you are the president or you think you're the president and you don't go along with what you're told to do, why, they will destroy you. And I'm sure that is actually what has happened many times in the past. And if you're smart, you just simply go along with the flow.
Oh. That's right. Well, I spoke with somebody recently who had a private conversation with Bill Clinton, who had explained to him that he said, are you kidding? Because the man asked him, why didn't you do this or this and this? He says, I could never have done that. And it wasn't for political reasons per se. It wasn't public perceptions. It was because of these interests that are in there. Even if they want to, even if whether it was a Bill Clinton or it was an Obama or a Nixon want to do things, they're seriously hemmed in by these interests. And this is not some abstraction. We're talking about very powerful, very wealthy interests, mostly people who, some of them are have made their money in recent years, particularly some of the independent oilmen out from Texas and Oklahoma and so on. But most of these people come from old line families that have owned goes all the way back to Cotton and what have you, and even before that. And they've always understood that to control power, you had to control natural resources. And so they always used the U.S. government and its foreign policy to secure everything from coffee to sugar to uranium to, of course, gold and so forth. And this is really what often drives the policy. And that's one of the themes, again, in my book, Family of Secrets, is I try to go through almost 50 years of post-war history to look at how these interests have dominated the presidency in order for them to control these resources through which they control ultimate power.
Well, hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment, but I agree with you. I think most people really don't understand. They think we are a democracy. We're not. We're run by an oligarchy, and we have a figurehead president. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest, of course, is Russ Baker, and we're talking about, well, how things are really run, not, of course, how we're told in this textbooks how they're run. Were you aware of these powerful forces before you started to write your book, Russ, or was this come as sort of a kind of a revelation to you?
Well, I mean, of course, I was aware of it in the sense that, you know, there are as so many books dealing with this general area, and so, you know, many of your listeners may say, well, I know that, but it's one thing to read analysis, kind of sweeping analysis and theory, if you will, and it's another thing to actually just confront all the names, the dates, and the specific things that people are doing. In Family of Secrets, I have more than 1,000 footnotes, and it's total transparency, because I want people to look at it and say, well, you know, is this guy a nut, or does he nail his stuff down? And so I guess, you know, on some abstract level, I understood that that there are constraints on our democracy, but I think I never realized the extent of it. And I want to say that it's not that I'm completely without hope. It's not that I don't think that democracy functions at all. It's that there is this constant battle going on between the forces that believe in democracy and the forces that do not. And, you know, it's very interesting. This battle is not new. This goes back to the founding of our country. And most people do not understand this because it's never emphasized well enough in the history textbooks, that there was a division right back at the beginning between, on the one hand, Alexander Hamilton and John Adams, who were very much believers that it was necessary for elites to rule, that the public, that the masses could not be trusted, and on the other hand, Thomas Jefferson and people like Tom Paine, who's really unsung and underappreciated, without whom there would be no United States of America, for his pamphlet, A Common Sense, which really was the call to arms that brought about the American Revolution. But anyway, there was this fundamental battle between these people about whether elites should run the country. You know, back then, of course, to vote in this country, you not only had to be basically white and male, but you had to be a property owner. You had to be of their class. And so this struggle exists to the present day. And amazingly, and I try to note this where I can in Family of Secrets, many of the people around the Bushes are actually descendants. Very
we're supposed to be spying overseas to protect our country. They're not supposed to operate in the United States, and yet does the CIA actually operate here in the United States and spy on the people in the White House?
Well, first of all, by its charter, it's prohibited from any domestic activity. But we know, because this was documented in congressional hearings, and it was admitted that they had something called domestic operations. They actually had an illegal domestic division, and so there's a problem right there. The other issue is that as I was working on the Watergate stuff, and the crux there, and we can talk about that if there's time, is that what I discovered was that Richard Nixon was not only not behind the Watergate burglary, but he wasn't even behind the cover-up. Richard Nixon was essentially being framed in order to control him and eventually to remove him from office. And that's what I document in Family of Secrets. It's the same group of people around the Kennedy assassination. It's elements. I don't want to say it's the whole CIA, because I think there are a lot of very patriotic people working at that agency who believe in this country and believe in democracy and are doing a great job, but there are very powerful interests within the agency, often at the top or even above the top, you might say, who don't share those sentiments. And so what we see in the Watergate in Skull and Bones have had intelligence ties. They've been involved in military military intelligence activities. They've been in positions where they were privy to top secret material, or many of them and are even people who were fairly recent graduates. They work at places like one works at the Washington Post as a columnist, another edits a magazine. I mean, these people, you know, you could say, well, that's just what people who go to Yale do, but I mean, this was a group that really only had a handful of members who were tapped for it each year. And it's astonishing to look at who they've been throughout history. They've been very much a part of this kind of establishment machine perpetrating the status quo. And, in fact, you go all the way back and you find the Bushes back in Ohio being, friendly with the Taft family. And, President William Howard Taft, Skull and Bones, and his ancestors, Skull and Bones. So this construct goes all the way back, and I don't want to overstate what it is exactly that those secret societies stand for, because I don't know, but I will say this. The principal purpose, I think, is to try to shape loyalties and to try to inculcate in people that their first loyalty is to each other and to these secrets that they swear to. And as I'm trying to remember which president it was, and one of the presidents, in fact, it may have been John Adams, come to think of it, and he said that it's dangerous for a country to have in its leadership people who make private oaths of secrecy to anything other than to their country.
I agree with you totally, and I share his concern. One of the things that really intrigued me was that your talk about George Bush and his supposed conversion to Christianity. And, of course, having met George Bush and hear him, you know, talk about how Billy Graham brought him into, into the kingdom of God, and how he was a born again Christian, and he radiated insincerity. This was in 1999. What was your take on George Bush's supposed conversion? Was this more a conversion of convenience?
Where the first half of Family of Secrets is mostly about the father, the second half mostly about the son, and the tone of the book shifts at that point, and it begins to focus principally, because the son is very interesting, but he's not as interesting in the father in the sense of those sorts of covert operations, although surprisingly it turns out he had what looked to be connections also with some covert operations ventures in his younger years. But specifically what I focus on is the uses of propaganda to shape him so that he can be elected to the highest office in the land. And that's where we get into the issue of religion. In Family of Secrets is one chapter which is only about that. And in that chapter, I establish, I think rather conclusively, that this so-called rebirth was engineered. And it was engineered literally by memo that the Bushes were basically warned that with the rise of the religious conservative bloc in this country, which began largely in the 70s, Jimmy Carter, it's kind of ironic, I mean, he was elected to the presidency in part with much of that vote as a Democrat, and then Ronald Reagan, who was not a religious man at all, suddenly embraced the Bible, and then he also benefited from this. Well, then along comes George H.W. Bush, and he is told, you better become friendly with Billy Graham, the confessor to presidents, and you better show that you're more religious and more religious and in a more fervent manner than as a sort of occasionally church-going New England Episcopal. And he sort of tried, but he just couldn't pull it off. And the son, George W. Bush, was really more charismatic and was a much better actor. And so we see that the son is a political advisor to his father in the 1980s and early 90s, and they are getting advice from a ordained minister who is telling them, you better get religion. And George W. Bush gets the message, and he then creates the story where he says that Billy Graham helped see the light. But we see from these memos that in fact they were getting this advice to do this well before the year in which he claims he and Billy Graham had this important walk on the beach. And by the way, Billy Graham doesn't remember any such walk on the beach, and it seems none took place.
Well, you know, I was actually with a group of about 20, 25 Christian leaders when they selected George Bush to become the next president. And it, I mean, I believe in, you know, the Christian evangelical movement, but it's amazing how gullible so many of our Christian leaders could be. And the 20, 22 that were there that day, I think there were only two of us, John Storm and myself, who saw through George Bush when he gave that phony story about Chris Billy Graham. And I mean, he just radiated insincerity, but he knew all the words. But, of course, it was obvious to me that he didn't believe any of them. But he sure snookered all. I mean, these are the real top-notch people. I won't put their names out because they're good people who love the Lord. But it's amazing how quickly they could be taken in when somebody uses the jargon, even if their life doesn't in any way suggest that they've walked the walk. What about, of course, you've got a great deal in there about George W. Bush's military service. I thought that was fascinating, and certainly, you know, the question is, was he really, of course, showing up for his military service in the National Guard, and why did he get in the National Guard rather than being sent over to Vietnam to fight like so many other boys? Did he get special treatment?
Well, you know, Dr. Stan, is another very important part of Family of Secrets, the military story. And so I spread that out over quite a few chapters, starting early in the book, and then I keep returning to it, because it's a kind of an animating theme of the rise of George W. Bush. And I think it's important when talking about this to say, well, you know, why should anybody, you know, address this issue? Why should I care about whether George W. Bush did his military service or not? What difference does that make in today, and especially now that he's gone? But I mean, the fact is that we have this country, thousands of Americans, young Americans, have died in Iraq and Afghanistan, enormous numbers of civilians in those places, for a war which we know was basically entered into by their selling the American people a bill of goods. And George W. Bush was very much behind this. And so he basically created this sort of elective and entirely unnecessary war, which in itself will be looked upon 50 or 100 years from now as an enormous controversial moment in American history. And so he did this thing and unleashed what could be sort of ongoing war for a very, very long time. And so the question is, you know, why did he do it? And what about his own values? And so in Family of Secrets, you know, there's that whole controversy. Remember Dan Rather and then those supposedly phony documents?
I've always felt that Dan Rather was set up on that. But
you're right, Dr. Stan. And in Family of Secrets, what I discover and I lay out is that Rather was set up. Basically, what appears to have happened is that George W. Bush basically appears to have failed to finish his obligatory military service. He avoided Vietnam, and you have to remember he and his father and grandfather, they were all supporters of the Vietnam War. They just wanted working class of people to go and die there. They didn't want their people to go there, and so they got him out of Vietnam duty into a safe National Guard unit. It was exciting flying a plane out of Houston, out of his hometown, and so he was supposed to serve 6 years, and it was not a hard thing, because after the initial training, it was just basically weekends and a few days a month, and that was it. But he, for whatever reason, was having trouble flying his plane, and he could not fly it anymore, and so he left his unit, and he didn't finish the last 2 years. Now, they clearly wanted to cover this up, because the father was already a prominent Republican official, and by the time it was clear that he had skipped out, the father was the chairman of the Republican Party, and he, I believe, was deeply involved with this whole Watergate operation, and the last thing he could stand was that kind of scrutiny of his son managing to get out of the military improperly. And so it seems that they covered this thing up for decades. And they covered it up, and they were so concerned that if this ever was focused upon by the media and the public began looking at it, and since the Bush's voting base was largely people very sympathetic with the military, veterans and what have you, they could not stand that scrutiny, just like if they couldn't stand the scrutiny of the religious issue, because they would lose that block too. I mean, if they didn't have those two blocks, I mean, he would got, you know, 25% of the vote. And so they could not let this come out. And I think what happened in 2004 was that somebody decided that the press was getting so hot on the trail of this. It was really a big debate. John Kerry was running against Bush. John Kerry, who, though he ended up opposing the war in Vietnam, did serve in Vietnam in a very, very dangerous capacity in the Swift boats. And so they were concerned that here that George W. Bush could lose this reelection bid with all of these stakes for all of these elites, and that Kerry could win. And so they needed to turn the apple cart upside down. And the way they did it was they produced there are these documents that I believe were produced falsely and given to CBS, and those documents were basically a covert operation. Again, you're talking about intelligence. These were documents that looked very much like what a real document would have looked like. They contained information that journalists such as Dan Rather and myself and others already knew to be essentially true, and the only thing was there were one or two tiny little things put in there that were anomalies. So if they could get CBS to put them on the air, they could then have somebody point out a very small anomaly and cry, that's a fake. And that's exactly what happened. They ruined Dan Rather. They forced him out. And for the rest of the campaign, no journalists were willing to go after Bush seriously.
And I think it was really a magnificent play, but it was all about the reality of the American people, convincing them that something that was true was false and exactly the opposite. So their masters are really at deceit, and obviously this was not something that, you know, George Bush did. This, there were powerful people behind this. This was a very well-organized program of deceit, and it sure fooled an awful lot of American people, because now they're arguing whether the documents are accurate or not whether George Bush actually avoided military service.
That's right, and Dr. Stan, that's the same thing as arguing about what caused Lee Harvey Oswald, why he would want to kill Kennedy, or focusing on, you know, Richard Nixon, and was he drinking heavily and cursing in his final months as president, you know, when none of these things have anything to do with what was going on. And so if you study it objectively, you see that in all of these instances, when there was some sort of a violent hiccup of the political and media process, in every case, there was a very professional deception engineer that was so skillful it could only have been engineered by deception professionals. And we know where those people get their training.
Amen to that. Well, now you talk about the personal secrets of George W. Bush. Maybe when we get back, we're just about done. We've got about three more minutes. For our listener out there, our guest has been, of course, Russ Baker's book, Family of Secrets. You want to get it, you want to read it. It'll change your impression of what really goes on behind the scenes. Well, what were some of these secrets that had to be covered up as far as George W. Bush was concerned?
There are quite a number throughout Family of Secrets. Deals with, you know, of course, he, as president, was, working his base. He was adamantly opposed to the right of abortion and to family planning, both domestically and abroad. And so, fine, that was his position. But in fact, according to credible accounts, when he was in the military, he had a girlfriend who, according to these accounts, became impregnated, and again, according to these witnesses, it was basically Bush and the people around him who forced her to have an abortion. And we, of course, back then, abortion was illegal in Texas. And so, you know, this, if this were true, and he was not, you know, 16 years old. I mean, he was in his late 20s, and he had had jobs, and he was in the military, and certainly he was old enough to know what his values were. And so that whole story, plus the fact that according to these accounts, she was taken swiftly to the hospital for this procedure by people who basically were kind of operatives on behalf of, you might say, the father. And George W. himself didn't even go to the hospital himself.
Well, of course, I'm certainly pro-life myself, but I feel that they use this, you know, the Republicans are pro-life, the Democrats are pro-choice, the the Republicans are family values. The Democrats want individual freedom, and you know, and this is simply all of this malarkey that goes along with the two-party system. And yet, of course, I think that they're used to convince the people there's a difference between the two parties. But when you get right down to it, there's not a lot of difference.
Well, I mean, these kind of hot button issues have always been used to divide us and to prevent us from focusing on the fact that in this country the wealth gap is growing. A small number of people keep getting richer while the rest of us have our savings at risk. Most of us are struggling as we speak, and this handful of people are doing extremely well. That really, if you talk about, you know, keeping your eye on the ball, that's the ball. The ball is the imbalances in this country, the lack of democracy, the lack of accountability, the lack of fairness and equity, and as long as they can keep us arguing about other things, they've got it made.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Look, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so very much for being with us for the hour, and I hope maybe sometime we can talk again in one of our other programs. God bless, and thanks so very much.
Thank you very much.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I do hope that you enjoyed our interview with Russ Baker. Basically, of course, we talk during the breaks, and if you'd like to get a CD or a tape of this, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like, of course, to know how this country really runs, you need to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. Who is behind the scenes? Who controls the wealth in this country? And who controls the people who control the wealth of the country? Brotherhood of Darkness, of what I feel is an excellent introduction to what's going on. Of course, we have other books going into this same subject, Rule by Secrecy by Tex Mars. Of course, we have a book by Ted Flynn on this subject. They're all available through Radio Liberty by calling 1-800-544-8927. But the truth of the matter is, nothing is it appears to be. We put together a syllabus on the membership list of the Brotherhood of Darkness, and you'll see the membership list of the Group of 30. It's certainly one of the most powerful groups in the world. It includes people like the current Secretary of State, Timothy Geithner, a chief advisor to the President, Larry Summers, Paul Volcker, a senior advisor to the President, and the head of the Bank of China. What's he doing in the Group of 30? Why, nothing, ladies and gentlemen, as it appears to be. But, of course, we have this called the Membership List of the Brotherhood of Darkness. It's a syllabus. And we give you the names of all of these people, and you'll get the membership list of the Trilateral Commission from the Trilateral Commission, the list of the people who attended the last secret Bilderberger meetings, because they do hold secret Bilderberger meetings. We've got a great DVD on the Bilderbergers. It's called Endgame. Actually, it's an Alex Jones DVD. We recommend it. We have Alex Jones' Secrets of the Bohemian Grove, and you'll see the leaders of our country. At least this time they're dressed. We don't have any pictures of them running around naked, but many times they do. But here now they're wearing their hoods and their gowns, and they're holding their candles and chanting in front of the sacred owl. And we have the material from the Bohemian Grove, saying we revere the owl. Now we have a 4-tape set on the Bohemian Grove. We have a DVD on the Bohemian Grove called The Secrets of the Bohemian Grove. On the Bilderbergers, we have 2 books. We have a 4-tape set. And, of course, we have a DVD. And these are simply examples of the secret societies. We have a 4-tape set on one of the most secret societies, Skull and Bones. In fact, when both Sean Kerry and George Bush were asked about the Skull and Bones Society by Tim Russert shortly before he died, both candidates for the presidency in 2004 said, the organization is so secret, we can't discuss it. Why do we want to have people who belong to secret societies in the presidency of the United States? Why, we've had many of them, because, of course, the world is run by far different people than most people guess. Actually, Russ Baker's book actually opens with a quotation from a tract I found, a letter I found at Yale University in Colonel House's papers. A letter from Franklin Delano Roosevelt to Colonel House in 1933, and if you'd like a copy of the letter, if you get any of our other items, we'd be glad to send it to you. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt writes, the real truth of the matter is, as you and I know, that a financial element in the large centers has owned the government ever since the days of Andrew Jackson. You'll actually see the letter. We have it. And, of course, we found so many fascinating things going through Colonel Ellis's papers and going through, of course, the papers of the Council on Foreign Relations, where they were planning on entering the Second World War, America's ending the Second World War, in 1938. Trouble was, the war didn't start until 1939. How did they know there was going to be a war? Why, the same reason they know there's going to be another war. In fact, right now, China is beginning to lay in all sorts of metals and the various things that she's going to need for the coming war, but we can't let the American people know that. And, of course, we're in for some terrible, terrible difficult times. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, radioliberty.com. We can hear our programs 9 hours a day. Please go there. And if you need a satellite, a special satellite, well, we can help you. But you can get it at radioliberty.com. And then please pray for Radio Liberty.